Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic on I-10 eastbound, an accident at the I-17 stack. Also on the 10 eastbound, an accident at Broadway Road. Sunny skies for the rest of the day. Look for a high topping out at 104. 94 is average for today. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the mid-70s. Sunny and 102 tomorrow. It's mostly sunny right now, 99 degrees at KJZZ.
Federal Judge Murray Snow has found Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio and three of his aides in civil contempt of court for violating court orders in a longstanding racial profiling case. Joining us now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block, who's been following the case. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Steve.
So this ruling's been a long time coming. Jude, tell us exactly what Judge Snow did today.
That's right. I mean, these civil contempt hearings began over a year ago at this point. And it all began when it came to light that there had been a few instances where the sheriff's office had not followed court orders. First, there had been a pretrial order to stop detaining immigrants who had not violated any state crimes. It came out that that order was never implemented. They had not handed over video evidence to the plaintiffs that were requested before the trial. And then it came out, the third thing is that they bungled the judge's orders for how to collect that video when its existence came to light. And so today, Snow found that Arpaio knowingly and intentionally violated those orders. He's holding Arpaio in contempt on three separate counts. He found Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan in contempt on two counts and two other aides in contempt on one count each.
Now, last year, we reported that Arpaio and Sheridan had admitted to violating the judge's orders and admitted they could be found in contempt. So is this ruling any sort of surprise?
Well, in some ways, no. For that reason, Arpaio and Sheridan did take responsibility last year. That was before the hearings began. They were trying to seek a settlement. But a key issue all along has been this issue of intent. Was it intentional to violate the court's orders? The judge today is saying, yes, it was, that it was knowing and intentional. The ruling says the sheriff and his staff engaged in multiple acts of misconduct, dishonesty, bad faith. The judge says there was testimony from the sheriff and Sheridan that misstated the facts, even.
And, Jude, who are the other two aides who are being held in contempt?
So both former Executive Chief Brian Sands, who's now retired, and Lieutenant Joseph Souza were found in contempt on one count each. Jack McIntyre, who's another chief, he's the fifth defendant in this case. He was found not to be in contempt.
Okay, so what happens now that we have this ruling?
So next up is a conversation about remedies. And so basically it comes down to the plaintiffs in this case. These are Latino motorists in Maricopa County. That's the plaintiffs. So what should be done in their interest given that these violations have happened? And so the judge has set a hearing for May 31st to discuss this further. He's given some clues about what some of the issues could be, how to compensate immigrants who were wrongfully detained by the sheriff's office. Another issue is likely to be reforms for the internal affairs and disciplinary proceedings. There's really some scathing remarks in the judge's order today referring to how those procedures are broken. And after this civil contempt matter is wrapped up, then we're expecting to hear from Judge Snow whether he will refer this to a prosecutor to pursue criminal contempt proceedings.
And Jude, finally, have you been able to talk to any of the parties involved to get their reaction?
So we've reached out to the lawyers from both sides and to the sheriff's office separately. So far, we've heard from Cecilia Wong of the ACLU. She represents plaintiffs in this case. She released a quote saying that the court has found that Sheriff Arpaio intentionally and repeatedly violated federal court orders. And she says his recalcitrance ends here. Strong remedies are needed to protect the community's rights, starting with internal investigations that root out and punish misconduct. So that was Cecilia Wong from the ACLU's comment on this matter.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block with the latest on Joe Arpaio. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
Governor Doug Ducey has signed into law three bills that he says will boost Arizona's sharing economy. The action follows the vision he laid out during January's State of the State speech.
Arizona should be to the sharing economy what Texas is to oil and what Silicon Valley used to be to the tech industry.
The bills will basically allow companies to pay taxes on behalf of their customers. That was a big issue for people who use home sharing services like Airbnb. Generally require new regulations to come from the legislature and clarify a business's relationship with an independent contractor. To get a sense of what kind of impact these bills might have on Arizona's sharing economy, I'm joined by John Frutkin with the Frutkin Law Firm. He's also written about this subject. And John, do you think these bills will have the effect the governor wants them to?
Well, it should. I mean, the nice thing about the trend in Arizona is that we've become more and more open to technology. You know, we've had a reputation in Arizona for being, for lack of a better word, backward with our government. And so it's kind of nice, as you see this battle going on throughout the country, that we're one of the states that's kind of a leader.
In your mind, should the goal be to have existing sharing economy type businesses be able to operate more freely here? Should it be to try to encourage sharing economy businesses to originate from here? Some combination of those, something else maybe?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, the most of these kind of new technologies and new companies are being driven out of Northern California. And although we do have some emerging type companies here, I think what the real focus has been thus far is kind of creating Arizona as an open platform. And that'll encourage businesses to start here. But along the way, consumers and businesses will be able to take advantage of this new sharing economy. Of course, there's the flip side, right? Which is we have all sorts of existing companies that are being displaced. And so there is a lot of pressure, both politically and economically, on different states to kind of resist the new economy.
You mentioned that most of these types of firms that have started up are coming from Northern California. Do you think that it's a realistic goal for Arizona, or maybe the Valley more specifically, to be in competition with that area?
Well, we've done a good job with kind of very specific growth technology companies here. And I think that there is a very strong public-private and university partnership throughout the Valley for technology companies. And I think that you continue to see more and more companies going to be birthed here. Obviously, the trend is in the sharing economy. And so you're going to see more and more companies from Arizona that will take advantage.
What do you think overall is the proper role for government in this sharing economy, and in the case of Arizona and Governor Ducey trying to boost it here?
Well, I think that, you know, there's only but so much Arizona can do by itself. But some of the things are very practical, not having different laws in different towns and cities. And some of the things that they are doing are symbolic. For example, saying about how we treat independent contractors and growth companies. A lot of these things are still being kind of mandated by the federal government. But the symbolism is important, especially when we're talking about a state like ours, where we've had such a history of people looking at us as backward. It really sends a message.
Do you think that efforts to boost the state's sharing economy might actually have more of an impact on our image elsewhere than on the state's economy?
I think that's right, because the fact of the matter is that the economic benefit of the sharing economy is relatively small in dollar terms. But our image has suffered over the years. And you kind of see what's happening now in North Carolina and some other places. And to just do these pro-business type of open-minded things really sends a message to other states that Arizona is really ready to compete with California and compete with Nevada and compete with the states around here for new businesses, and that we're serious about having legislation that's going to promote new things.
John Frutkin is a principal with the Frutkin Law Firm in Scottsdale and the author of the book Equity Crowdfunding. APS this week confirmed it'll ask regulators to approve demand rates when they take up the utility's rate case this summer. That would change how ratepayers are charged by Arizona's biggest utility, and critics say it'll mean higher bills for those customers. Rachel Leingang has written about this. She's a reporter for the Arizona Capital Times, and she joins me. So, Rachel, let's start at the beginning. What exactly does demand charge mean?
Right now, when we pay our electric bills, we're paying basically for the volume of power that we use over the course of a month, and then there's some fixed fees. And what this would do is change the way that rates are designed overall. So instead of paying for the volume that we use over the course of the month, we would pay for the peak demand, meaning like the highest amount of power that we use during a one-hour period throughout the course of the month.
And how is that determined?
It's determined by however much you're basically taxing the grid. So if you're using your dryer and your washing machine and your oven and other appliances all at the same time, you'd probably hit peak demand, and then they would add a certain amount of charge to that demand. And that part hasn't been announced yet. They'll officially file what that would be on June 1st.
So we don't know what ratepayers might be paying extra as a result of this if the Corporation Commission approves it.
Right. So what we know now is that it's a big change in the way that we're assessed. We don't know what the specific fee would be or what the average increase would be for a general customer because those specifics aren't available yet.
Why does APS say it needs this?
So as I'm sure a lot of people know, over the past couple of years, solar energy in the state has taken off, and APS says that these new technologies have changed the way that they need to assess customers because the way rates are structured now don't really allow for technologies like solar that don't use power all the time but still require an electrical grid. So they're saying that new technologies have basically kind of moved forward, forced the hand to come up with a new rate design.
Is it a matter of selling energy isn't profitable enough anymore?
It very well could be. We probably all use less energy than we did previously, and appliances are becoming a lot more efficient, and that means that we don't use the same amount of power that we did probably 30 years ago. So changing the way that rates are structured can help allow the utility to still kind of make the same amount of money that it did and bring its demand that it needs. Basically, they have to have power plants at the ready, and they're saying that those power plants still cost money, and the way that we're using power now still draws on those plants, even though it's not the same volume that it was a long time ago.
What do critics of this plan say it would do to ratepayers?
They say it's really confusing and it's overly punitive. So people don't know their peak demand at any given time. I mean, they're not really monitoring their power that way. So they're not really sure when they're hitting peak. They might accidentally hit a peak amount of power earlier in the month, and then they're not able to conserve and bring their bill back to a lower amount. And it's just basically a complete change from the way we're doing power now.
Has this ever been done in a residential utility setting before? Obviously, APS was involved in another Arizona Utilities case earlier this year, but that didn't end up going anywhere. So are there other utilities that have done this elsewhere?
From what I've seen, this is the first one in the nation that's proposing mandatory residential demand rates for all of its customers. A lot of utilities have had optional opt-in sort of rates like this for their customers over the past decades, but never a mandatory one.
Well, it seems like APS could be the utility's version of a canary in the coal mine on this going forward.
They very well could be. I mean, it's once one utility has done something like this, other utilities start to pay attention.
Rachel Leingang is a reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. She wrote the piece for the newspaper on APS seeking a demand rate for its customers when it files its rate case next month. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. Every year around this time, tens of thousands of law enforcement officers from across the country gather for a memorial in Washington, D.C., in a week of meetings, bonding, and general all-around solidarity.
FBI Director James Comey delivered a video message for the officers coming this year and the 137 officers, deputies, and agents killed on the job in 2015.
These tragedies remind us that our safety and our freedoms, which we hold so dear, are purchased at great cost.
It's National Police Week. And is this an appropriate outlook for law enforcement? Certainly no one would begrudge them a week of R&R in the nation's capital. But are police officers a separate team from the citizens they protect? Is a circling the wagon, us versus them culture of policing compounding the problems today? FBI Director Comey this week addressed one of those problems across the country by referencing what he called a viral video effect that may be at the heart of a spike in homicides across the country since January.
Director Comey can't overlook the possibility that perhaps it's poor management in police departments. Perhaps officers are being told to pull back. We've heard that from a number of quarters, that officers are being told to stand down. And this certainly is as much a possibility as his totally unfounded assertion.
That's James Pascoe Jr., executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police. Can it be said that viral videos are the problem and that the cost of a new accountability by police officers to their citizens is a fall-off in tough crime enforcement? Do we accept that or call it a form of extortion? You prosecute us for brutality, we will relax or hesitate in our enforcement of violent crime. Well, of course, no one is saying that. But Jeff Asher, a crime analyst based in New Orleans, has recently taken a look and found both a surprising jump in murder rates over the winter and a decrease in arrests following the police killings of civilians in Chicago. Is there a viral video mentality? Citizen videos have revealed brutal and deadly policing tactics. Just over a year ago, Freddie Gray, his arrest caught on a cell phone camera, led to outrage and months of protests in Baltimore. DeRay McKesson, activist and former candidate for mayor in Baltimore, joins us now. So is there a general way in which these police murders of the last year or two have created an overall change in the environment for law enforcement and for civilians?
What we do see is more scrutiny to the police across the country in a way that I think is important. We see the police officers being held accountable and people asking questions about police accounts and police reports in ways that simply were not happening in the public space before August of 2014. And I think that is really important. What we haven't seen, though, is any causation between police accountability and any spike in crime or arrests or violence in communities. That is a myth. It's disappointing that Comey continues to perpetuate what we know to be untrue.
Jeff Asher, is the Chicago situation and the data you found in Chicago, does it support this idea of police maybe, you know, backing off as a way of responding to the viral video mentality that Director Comey is talking about?
Well, something definitely changed in Chicago, and we were able to correlate it chronologically very closely with the release of the Laquan McDonald video in November of last year. And it's not just that gun violence went up right after the video was released at a time when traditionally we would expect gun violence to be going down as the Chicago winter sets in. In addition, arrests went down significantly, but also a lot of the measures of proactive policing. Rob Arthur and I, in our 538 article, brought up drug violations as a measure of proactive policing. And December of 2015 saw the largest decrease from 1 month to the next in terms of drug violations in the previous 10 plus years in Chicago.
Although here is a, quite frankly, bitter sounding response from James Pascoe Jr., the executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police.
You know, it's possible that police officers are doing the job to the best of their ability every single day, risking their lives out there to keep America as safe as possible, given the poverty and the failed economy and the failed educational system and the rotting infrastructure that people are forced to live within.
DeRay McKesson, what concerns me about what Pascoe is saying there and all of this is that it's possible that police and the civilian world are responding to everything that's happened since 2014 in very different ways. In other words, we're not finding common ground, we're finding separate tents to go under. Do you feel that?
I think the public has been incredibly open to having a conversation about what should change. I have not seen police departments around the country actually be as open to talk about and acknowledge that there's something with the policing culture that is problematic. I think that Pascoe's comments actually highlight the problematic nature when he is suggesting that this is just as good as it can get. That, like, if Laquan McDonald is a casualty of good policing, how he defines it, then that just is what it is. And I think that's really dangerous. And Asher's research, I think, is interesting. I think that we should continue to ask these questions to get to why. I want to be careful, though, to note that there's nobody saying that this is causation, that he is saying that there seems to be correlation and this could be one answer, but in no way is that definitive. I think the data set is actually not large enough to say anything conclusive.
Jeff Asher, is it possible that FBI Director Comey's remark, viral video effect, may conceal some pattern that they're seeing in the FBI data, because they do have a huge amount of crime stats?
The way that crime data is collected and organized and distributed in this country makes answering that question virtually impossible. It won't be until September of 2016 until we'll actually see the FBI's 2015 data. There's no way of really knowing whether or not the FBI has data about 2016 trends that we're unable to decipher, unable to analyze. All of the open crime data that's available right now provides us some glimpse into what is happening in 2016. And it doesn't suggest that there's been some sort of national sea change.
So that suggests, DeRay, that you know, what Comey is saying borders on irresponsible. I mean, he's talking about stuff that he may or may not have information on, but he makes this blanket statement that suggests that law enforcement isn't interested in accountability.
So he continues to make it, and that's actually what's most problematic, is that President Obama, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, they have distanced themselves from ever making these statements in public. They don't make them. They talk about this data, and they talk about what's happening in these three cities specifically with much more nuance. And Comey has been dogmatic about suggesting that the Ferguson effect is real. And recently he's saying he's not calling it the Ferguson effect, but he is essentially saying the exact same thing. And that's a real problem. But when we think about a whole culture change, that this has to be deeply rooted and systemic. And we've just not seen police officers or police chiefs publicly rally around that. And that has to be a part of the work. And Comey's statements don't encourage collaboration. They continue to encourage this friction, especially because it's not based in facts.
DeRay McKesson is an activist and former candidate for mayor in the city of Baltimore. Jeff Asher is a crime analyst based in New Orleans who's written for 538. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
DeRay, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
Emergency room doctors are not happy with insurance companies. That's the result of a new survey from the American College of Emergency Physicians. It surveyed almost 2,000 ER doctors in all 50 states, and 9 in 10 of those surveyed said health insurance companies are shortchanging patients, offering affordable policies that end up sticking the patient with a big bill. The show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. And Lauren, these are pretty strong results.
They are, and there are more. The survey found that 80% of ER doctors surveyed say insurance companies have reduced the amount they reimburse for emergency care, and 8 in 10 doctors say patients sacrifice care because of out-of-pocket costs. I talked to Dr. Donald Lauer about this. He's the president of the Arizona College of Emergency Physicians, the state chapter of the national group that did this survey. And his bottom line is very simple.
Patients can't choose when and where they'll need an emergency, need emergency care, and so they shouldn't be punished for having emergencies.
Right. Well, Lauren, emergency departments won't turn anyone away even if they don't have health insurance. So is this costing them?
Lauer says there's definitely an economic impact on doctors and hospitals.
It's very hard for patients to pay these bills. So what often happens is, we don't get paid, the hospital doesn't get paid.
He says someone goes to a hospital that's in their network and they think everything's going to be covered.
But what happens is they show up and the emergency department isn't covered under their plan. The radiologist isn't covered under their plan. Let's say they need an operation just to fix a broken bone, let's say a hip. The orthopedic surgeon isn't on their plan, and neither is the anesthesiologist. This can add up to a lot of costs.
Has this gotten worse? I mean, what's changed about this?
Well, Lauer says it has gotten worse across the country and here in Arizona. He says it used to be worse a few years ago when a lot of people didn't have health insurance at all. Then when the Affordable Care Act passed, he saw it improve. More patients had health insurance and were covered. But he says that's changing now because insurance companies are creating narrower networks of medical providers who are covered by your plan.
Well, certainly on the exchanges, the options are being limited. What's happening is a narrowing of insurance coverage. So your network, that is the physicians you can see within your plan, is shrinking. So within that plan, usually your primary care physician, of course, is in that plan. But very important specialists such as emergency room physicians, radiologists, cardiologists, orthopedic surgeons, less and less are being covered.
So the American College of Emergency Physicians is calling for insurance companies to be more transparent with patients about what their plans cover and what they don't. The survey also found that 96% of the 2,000 ER doctors surveyed don't think patients understand what their policies cover when it comes to emergency care, and they think insurance companies should provide more coverage for emergencies.
Well, what did the health insurance industry have to say about all this?
I called a National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. They represent the health insurance industry. Claire Cruising is their press secretary, and she says they certainly recognize that someone isn't going to look up their provider network and check what doctors are covered by their insurance plan when they're being rushed to the emergency room. But she says hospitals and doctors need to do more, too.
It's important that there is a level of transparency there from the hospital, from the physician, and from everyone that is treating that patient to make sure that they are aware of the choices that are available to them and that the patient isn't surprised or facing a huge bill at the end of the day.
That's Claire Cruising with the industry group America's Health Insurance Plans. She's responding to a recent survey of ER doctors about insurance coverage for emergency care. And we'll link to the results of that survey on our website at theshow.kjzz.org.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
The Valley's arts scene has a new leader. If I told you he wanted to be the lead singer in a hair band when he was 12 years old, you may not guess he's taken over as president and general director of Arizona Opera. But that's exactly what Joseph Spector has done. I met Spector in his office at the opera's Central Avenue headquarters as he was getting settled in. He's still finishing up some work for his current position in Austin. We started by talking about whether Phoenix offers unique challenges since so much of our population comes from somewhere else and may be inclined to support arts groups in their old home city.
We have a similar sort of paradigm in Austin. A lot of folks that are also residents part of the year in other states and are lovers of the art form and might support another institution like Chicago Lyric, like Santa Fe. And I would just suggest to those people that they redirect all of their funds to Arizona Opera. Be a fantastic way to reallocate their portfolio. But in all seriousness, you know, the onus for inspiration is on us. And I truly believe that regional opera has a powerful ability to engender that kind of support. It's up to us to do it right, though.
And do it right when people know about you, or is there education that needs to happen? Do more people need to know Arizona Opera exists? And then do they need to know that it's maybe not what some people would have stereotyped as opera, that it is accessible to everybody?
Repertoire selection is the most important strategic decision that any opera company makes. And I think our ability to reach a community is dramatically impacted by us having the right profile artistically and as the season represents. And if we get that right, then the awareness of the company grows. I think it would be very, very capital intensive and probably not ultimately successful to have a huge campaign where we go out and say, hey, we're here, guys, and by the way, come do a show. What people are sitting at home doing is they're thinking about what they can do tonight. They're thinking, they're not just thinking, can I go to the opera, the ballet, or the symphony? I think that's a very insular way of thinking. People are thinking, can I watch 6 hours of House of Cards on Netflix? Or can I go out to a nice dinner or go to the gym tonight? And there are aspects of competition in what we do that haven't been wholly considered as a field. And so we really, really need to be thinking about that. If we program correctly, we think about the way we present the art in the right way, we'll capture the attention of those kinds of audiences.
There's also always the concern about getting the next generation. And that happens with arts, it happens in public radio too. How do you get that next group to be as loyal as their parents and grandparents were? What do you think about that?
Again, I think that goes to the changing ways in which people are consuming the arts. And rather than trying to force a paradigm on that generation, really think about how people want to embrace the arts, how people are prepared to embrace the arts. And to, you know, I don't think that any individual arts organization has the ability to, or nor should, try to influence people's consumption habits. I think what we do is we put on the work that's going to attract those audiences. They come once every 2 years, every 3 years, it's fine. Going to people where they are, whether it's physically, emotionally, thematic content, that has to be the spirit that drives us. Putting the people who are the patrons of this art form and putting the people who are not the patrons yet of this art form first, and orienting ourselves strategically toward what they want. And then figuring out how that aligns with the art. That's the order of operations. It's not what we want to do first, and then how do we get people to obey? I think the time has long passed when that was a viable approach.
So finally, what made you love this art form?
I wanted to be a hairband rocker when I was a kid, and no one would teach, you know, a little 12-year-old kid with a mullet growing up in Miami, Florida, how to sing. You know, like Kip Winger or something like that. That's a terrible example, but let's say Bon Jovi. And I started training classically as a way to get to my dream of being a rock musician. And over a period of time, the aesthetic of the voice, of the classically trained voice, just started having such a powerful impression on me. That was solidified at a few key moments. Two summers in Tanglewood as a high school student were really instrumental, just total immersion in classical music. And I felt like I had found something special in that process that a lot of people didn't know about. And there was something so amazing about feeling like I was part of a little segment of society that had a secret. And the secret was how beautiful this art form is and that we get to share that. What I'm excited about here is the idea of not keeping it such a secret.
Joseph Spector, he's the new president and general director of Arizona Opera.
In KJZZ News, a federal judge has found Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio and three deputies in contempt of court for disobeying his orders in a racial profiling case. In his ruling, Judge Murray Snow wrote, Arpaio and the others, quote, have demonstrated a persistent disregard for the orders of this court, as well as an intention to violate and manipulate the laws and policies regulating their conduct. Arpaio has acknowledged violating Snow's orders. A local attorney who tried to stop next week's special election is now calling for the impeachment of Secretary of State Michelle Reagan. It's in response to a glitch that prevented hundreds of thousands of voters from receiving their ballot guides far enough in advance of voting. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
Lawyer Tom Ryan had asked the Attorney General to delay next week's election because of the mess-up. That's after Secretary of State Michelle Reagan's office confirmed last week that 200,000 households did not receive their publicity pamphlets, the required 10 days before voting. While the Secretary of State did violate the law, the Attorney General will not intervene this close to the election, but he is investigating what happened. Meanwhile, Tom Ryan is calling for the legislature to impeach Reagan.
It's about whether or not the Secretary of State has the right to put her thumb on the scale and defeat the citizens' right to get the message out that opposes or supports a particular bill that she's out campaigning on.
Ryan contends Reagan not only tried to cover up the mistake, but is biased toward Proposition 123, the governor's plan to tap the state land trust for billions in education funding. The pamphlets contain arguments for and against that ballot question. As many as 400,000 voters or more could have been affected. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Governor Ducey signed two bills into law today that could effectively end dog racing in Arizona by the end of the year. As KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, the Tucson Greyhound Park was the last track in the state to offer live racing.
One measure removes taxpayer support from the track by repealing a hardship tax credit. The other bill removes a state mandate that Tucson Greyhound Park had to offer live racing at the track in order to offer simulcast wagering and operate off-track betting sites. The legislation also allows the track to end live racing by the end of June and still keep simulcast contracts with other tracks that generate hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. More than 400 dogs live and race at the track. Some of them will be moved to other tracks and used for breeding. Adoption groups are working with the track and kennel owners to find the remaining greyhounds a home. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Valley's apartment market is booming. The first quarter of this year boasted the Phoenix area's highest ever rents and lowest ever vacancies. That's all according to an analysis by Pete Tecamp. He's Vice President Investments at the real estate investment services firm Marcus & Millichap in Phoenix. And when you dig down into the numbers, there are a few surprises, including the fact that the highest vacancy rates in the Valley are in Uptown and Central Phoenix, considered pretty popular parts of town.
The reason why that vacancy is so high is because there have been so many new units added to that market, and that market is absorbing those units.
You found the highest rent in the South Scottsdale market, $1,184. That doesn't seem like a market that we hear about a lot that like has a lot of demand and has a lot of new units coming online and that a lot of people want to live in.
Well, South Scottsdale is very desirable because of Old Town, proximity to the 101 freeway. It's adjacent to East Central Phoenix, and it borders this little known area known as North Tempe, where Arizona State University happens to be. There has been quite a bit new construction in the South Scottsdale submarket over the last couple of years. That has driven rents up, and vacancies have actually been kept in check, so they are absorbing units.
When we've spoken in the past, you've talked a lot about how there are a lot of new projects coming online, and a lot of them tend to be the higher end. Class A, I think, is
yes.
the lingo for it. The units that we continue to see online coming now, are they still the high-end luxury-type places?
8,082 units are coming out of the ground as we are sitting here speaking, but who's counting?
And, well, you are.
we pay attention to that. But most of that, I'd say 95% of it, is Class A, the really high-end, super, super nice communities, full amenity package, nice fixtures in the units. I see we're in the nascent stages of some either LIHTC, low-income housing tax credit projects, either being built or acquisition rehab, or some more subsidized type affordable housing projects, or extensions of additional phases of existing affordable, either subsidized or some type of incentive to allow a developer to build a project that caters to the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. So we're seeing a little bit of that, but that is actually a segment of the market. The B and C market is severely underserved.
One of the other numbers I wanted to ask you about was the Valley's concession ratio, which seems to have had a pretty substantial drop from the first quarter of last year, from 53% down to 38%. That seems like a pretty big drop.
Yeah, the percentage of communities that offer concessions, and we hand count them every quarter, it has dropped. And that's just another signal or sign of the strength of the rental market. Landlords don't have to offer as many concessions as they did in the past to entice the renters in, because the rental market has gotten so tight. There is incredible demand for apartments right now, both from an investor standpoint and from the consumer standpoint.
You think that this is going to continue for the foreseeable future, as you said. Where are the hot areas going to continue to be around the Valley? Where should we look to continue to see construction cranes?
Well, construction is big in Tempe, and especially North Tempe around the school. Anywhere along the light rail route is gold. I think Scottsdale is always a hot area. North Scottsdale at the intersection of the 101 and Scottsdale Road, as well as South Scottsdale, Chandler, Southeast Valley is very strong, and the central urban core here. So those are the areas that tend to get the most play, and then Central Avenue, but along the light rail route. But the thing right now that's going on is, and I actually had a conversation earlier today where an investor said, it's really hard to go wrong in the apartment game in Phoenix right now, and I tend to agree with him.
Pete DeCamp is Vice President Investments at the real estate investment services firm Marcus & Millichap. Pete, thanks a lot.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
Las Vegas' McCarran Airport may soon become a site featuring 3 times a week direct service to Beijing, China. Phoenix's Sky Harbor Airport doesn't have any service to Asia at this point. Since Sky Harbor is considered a major economic driver for the region, how much of a focus should expanded international service be? To talk more about that, I'm joined by Alan Morrison, CEO and Director General of the Thunderbird School of Global Management at ASU. Alan, how significant is Sky Harbor as a conduit for the Valley to get more international business connections?
I think the airport is, in fact, an important driver of economic development for the city and also for the state for a number of reasons. One of those reasons is to bring tourists to the Valley. The more nonstop flights we have, the better, because it's more convenient for travelers. Particularly international travelers are drawn to the desert Southwest, and having more nonstops for them certainly puts us on the map in their decision set of where they want to visit. I think, quite frankly, more importantly, it is a driver of economic growth outside of the tourism industry, and as a result, plays an important role in the location of companies, where companies want to do business, how they do business, where they locate their head offices. And as a result, I think it is not just important in the short term, but important in the long-term economic growth of the state, and particularly the city of Arizona.
Now, we've read recently that Las Vegas is poised to have some flights to China. Las Vegas, obviously not far away from the Valley. Is this something that, from a competitive aspect, we should have any concerns about? The Vegas connection to China, which Arizona doesn't quite have in the same way?
We've got it wrong when we think of Vegas as a competitor for these nonstop flights. The international traffic flying into Vegas is primarily tourism-based travel. And I think very clearly Phoenix would welcome the tourist traveler. But I think the bigger issue for Phoenix is nonstop for business travel, and here's the trick, and it's a real vicious circle for Phoenix. Without more global headquarters based in Phoenix, Arizona, we will not have enough business class seats that companies are paying for. And without the business class seats, we will not get the nonstop flights, the long-haul nonstop flights. And so the big driver for the the economics of long-haul travel is not the tourist traveler, it's the business traveler. And so when we don't have enough corporate headquarters, particularly globally oriented corporate headquarters, or at least major regional offices for multinational companies, we won't get enough business passengers. And without business passengers, the flights get filled with tourists. And when flights are filled with tourists, we will not, the economics do not favor long-haul travel.
The headquarters issue, global or otherwise, has been a tough one around here for quite a while, certainly at least a decade or so. What are the steps to be taken to prioritize that? Because it's a very competitive market out there.
It is a very competitive market, and we seem to be going the opposite direction of many cities. We're losing more corporate headquarters through acquisitions, through bankruptcies, through relocations. And the concern that I have is that the direction of that trend line needs to change. How do we get more kind of Fortune 500 companies basing their operations in Phoenix? Well, you can either grow them here or you can attract them here.
Alan Morrison is Chief Executive Officer and Director General of the Thunderbird School of Global Management at ASU. Alan, thank you for the insights.
Thank you.
Many of TV's most critically acclaimed shows over the past decade or so have featured the so-called anti-hero, flawed protagonists like Walter White of Breaking Bad and Don Draper of Mad Men.
That's the way it works. There are no credits on commercials.
Then you got the Clio.
It's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for. Everything to you is an opportunity. And you should be thanking me every morning when you wake up, along with Jesus, for giving you another day.
I'm sorry, do I know you?
I'm on my grunts.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
You stole $12,000 worth of Roxy's off me.
So what, are you a drug dealer? Why don't you call the cops? They can handle this.
You don't want to f*** with me.
You come into my hospital and you threaten me? Do you have any idea how many cops are going to be up your ass if you lay a finger on me?
You clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. I am the one who knocks.
The clips we just heard were in order, Mad Men, Nurse Jackie, and Breaking Bad. Now the History Channel has decided the ultimate anti-hero of a fictionalized program should be based on a real live person, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The drama will be called Cartel. With me to talk about the popularity of anti-heroes, main characters that can be difficult to like and identify with, is Praveen Kambam, a forensic psychiatrist who's written about and presented on the topic of pop culture. Praveen, why have so many viewers and creators been drawn to these anti-heroes?
The anti-hero is basically the protagonist that doesn't have the traditional hero qualities and idealism, but there's something that's so compelling about them for us, and I think it's because it mirrors real life in some ways. You know, all of us have some morally ambiguous positions, you know, and there's parts of us that feel like maybe the law doesn't go far enough in certain instances, or there are injustices that happen because of society that, because of our rules, maybe don't get addressed fully. And with an anti-hero, they kind of can bend around the rules a little bit, maybe for a higher purpose and maybe for something that we can relate to, but they're not bound by the same rules that we are.
How long ago did pop culture and entertainment get away from the white hat versus black hat kind of thing? Did that just get to be passé?
Yes. I mean, if you look at how the 20th century progressed, right, the initial protagonists were a little bit more of that black-white absolutist kind of thinking in terms of this is good, this is bad. You can even see that in kind of the progression of characters even from the 80s and onwards. And as we've moved into this, quote, golden age of television, you've seen Breaking Bad and other dramas that have really brought out the anti-hero. It's possible we're even going farther than that now when we're looking in terms of the minds of the, quote, villains. You know, look in Making of the Murderer, and you look at Suicide Squad coming out where the villains actually become the heroes or the anti-heroes. So it's an interesting kind of trend that's happening.
Now that we've reached the stage of having so many sort of anti-heroes or so many lead characters that are, you know, maybe talented and whatnot, but a little bit, they're flawed, let's put it that way. Do you think we're going to continue in that sort of direction, or at some point do we sort of hit the reverse and do a 180?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think we're actually doing both right now. There's still a place for the movies like The Avengers where you still have that epic hero feel to it, and it works, you know. So I think both of these things are going on. I'd be curious to see how far we go with into the anti-hero villain path. How shocking will that become as we go forward?
We have heard that now there's going to be a fictionalized series of the drug lord El Chapo. What about the idea of a program like this featuring an anti-hero actually based on a real person who's still alive?
In fiction, we have a separation, seeing that it's TV, quote, TV and not reality. When we see the anti-hero as real in real life, it really depends on how they portray him. If they can portray him as some sort of humanity to him or some sort of purpose that we can relate to, I think then we would see him the same way we would in fiction. If they don't do that, I think then they are going to have to make it where he is shocking, or we're following what he's going to do in terms of a very dark path. But to keep it relatable, I think they're going to have to show some kind of humanity or some sort of purpose, like they did with, you know, some of these other fictional shows like, you know, Breaking Bad.
Forensic psychiatrist Praveen Kambam. We've been talking about anti-heroes in pop culture.
Hemophilia is a blood disorder that keeps blood from clotting properly. It's inherited and there's no cure, but it is treatable by regularly injecting a protein that helps the blood clot.
A program at the Phoenix Children's Hospital called Infusion Boot Camp is teaching kids with hemophilia how to do these injections all on their own. The show's Annika Klein visited the latest meeting.
And this meeting happens to be the last one for this round of boot camp.
And then before we start, are you able to tell me all the supplies that you have to get?
The four boys here are ages 8 to 13. And they're being tested on what they've learned over the past month.
Syringe, needle, gauze, and...
They lay out the supplies for an infusion.
Band-aid and tourniquet.
Including the most important item.
And what's the name of your factor? You guys remember that?
Factor 8!
That's the clotting protein. And today, the boys are going to inject it themselves, with the nurse's help.
Ready, buddy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It takes bravery to put the needle in, but it's important to learn. They have to do this multiple times a week to keep their factor levels up.
You're doing awesome. Just go for it. Good job.
It takes a few tries on both arms for Clayton Cooper to get the right spot.
Well, my veins are really small, so I can't really get them all the time.
Watching 8-year-olds stick themselves with needles, you know, that's impressive, and it's scary.
Becky Garcia is the nurse coordinator for the Phoenix Children's Hemophilia Center. It's one of two centers in the state. Working with these patients, Garcia found the most helpful thing she could do was teach rapid treatment, meaning if something happens, infuse first, ask questions later.
For a family to be able to, and a child to be able to say, hey, I know I'm starting to get a bleed in my knee, I'm going to treat now, it causes a dramatic difference in the quality and the outcome of that bleed.
Because getting that protein into the blood means it'll clot and not cause bigger issues. Some kids learn how to do it themselves at special summer camps. But Garcia says they often stop doing it shortly after.
And then come camp again, they're kind of starting from square one and they really haven't been doing it.
So she decided to start a more involved program that brings the parents in too. According to the Centers for Disease Control, there are 146 hemophilia centers around the country, but none have a program like this, Garcia says. She knows because she looked.
I didn't want to reinvent the wheel, but I wasn't able to find any kind of a similar program where it was on a consistent basis over a long period of time.
One explanation for why this didn't exist before might be that hemophilia is a rare disease. An estimated 20,000 people in the U.S. have it. That's good for the population as a whole, but for those who are affected, it means they get less attention on the research front.
We knew nothing.
Christine Cooper is Clayton's mom.
This was a spontaneous mutation. We don't have any family history of this.
So when the Coopers learned their 3-day-old son had hemophilia, they thought they were looking at a boy who wouldn't be physically active.
That will never be able to run at school. That will probably always be on crutches.
Not the case, thanks to the treatment, which Garcia says is fairly new. It's still very expensive, starting at $6,000 for 1 week's supply of the protein. But in the past few decades, it's allowed people with hemophilia to lead normal lives, which is what the Coopers want for their son.
He's going to be playing club soccer. He's going to be on the top team. He's going to be slide tackling. He's going to be kicking some serious butt.
You did awesome.
It's time for ice cream and awards. Garcia hands out cloth patches for each skill.
This is that you know your factor product, your dose, and your frequency.
The boys will use these skills for the rest of their lives.
And then this one is you know how to order your factor.
They have a disorder that not a lot of people understand, but it's always present. So the best advocate for each of these boys is themselves. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.